Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. We're going to do something a little different today and tomorrow. I'm calling it kind of a pop-up mini-series on capitalism and its discontents. Today, we'll talk about capitalism and how we got to here. And tomorrow, we'll question the future of the system that currently rules the world. So today, about capitalism's recent past, somehow, a little more than a half century ago, the absolute belief in the supremacy of free markets migrated from the offices of the Economics Department at the University of Chicago right to the beating heart of American political thought. Free markets became sacrosanct, a bipartisan religion. I think of the economists that ushered in that transformation as the madmen of mid-century American capitalism. Their charisma and ideas helped shape a people's beliefs and desires about free markets, and some of those ideas changed the world massively and for the better. But they also convinced people to believe in the system even when it wasn't working in everyone's favor. So how'd they do that? That is the story you'll hear this hour on Point: False Prophets, Free Markets, and the Fracture of Society. And you can join us. How have free markets changed the world for better or for worse? Join us anytime on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining us today is Binyamin Applebaum. He writes about economics and business for the editorial page of The New York Times. And his new book, I borrowed the subtitle from it just a second ago, his new book is called The Economist's Hour: False Prophets, Free Markets, and the Fracture of Society. Binyamin Applebaum, it's great to have you back on the show.
Hi, Meghna.
So let's start where you start in the book, and this kind of eye-opening revelation for those of us who weren't there at the time, that economists once were relegated to the dank, dark basements of American government. They were so little regarded. How is that possible?
Yeah, you know, I begin the book with the story of a young economist who works at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York in the bowels of the institution, basically just doing math for the people who actually run the place. He comes home one night and he tells his wife, this is in the early 1950s, that he doesn't see any hope of building a career at the Fed. There's just no place for economists there. And he's not wrong or crazy. The Fed's board at the time doesn't include a single economist. It includes an Iowa hog farmer, a bunch of bankers, but no economists. The head of the Fed actually says that he keeps his few economists in the basement because they ask good questions, but they don't know their own limitations. And so this economist is you know, home with his wife saying, basically, I don't see a future. That's the early 1950s. The guy's name is Paul Volcker. By the end of the 1970s, he's running the place.
He's running the place and has a massive impact on the U.S. economic thinking and how the economy is run here. I mean, so what was it about economists in Volcker's youth that policymakers didn't have any time for, let alone any respect for?
Well, a big part of it is that macroeconomics, the idea that you could measure and evaluate and manage the economy, was a pretty new idea in the world. When the Great Depression happened in the United States, Congress looked around and realized they didn't even know how big the economy was. And so they hired an economist to measure it for the first time. And he came back a couple years later and said, basically, it was this big and now it's a lot smaller. But that was the first time that anyone had measured it. And once you measured it, then you could begin to think about managing it. And so this whole sort of idea that there were these people called economists who could help policymakers was still a relatively new thing in the world. And, that's one thing.
Oh, no, go ahead. And the other things?
Well, the other thing is just that people didn't have a lot of faith in the need for economists. There was a system in place to manage the economy. There was a sense that the government needed to be very involved in regulating the way that the economy worked. It was an extremely hands-on approach. And people who said, basically, you know, take your hands off the wheel, just let markets work, were thought to be a little crazy.
Okay, so let's talk about who some of those people are, beginning with a central figure in your book, and I want to first just hear his voice for a moment. Here is Milton Friedman, Nobel Prize winner, possibly one of the most influential economists in the world for several decades. This is him from 1996, quoting a section of his 1962 book, Capitalism and Freedom. Here's what he said.
Historical evidence speaks with a single voice on the relation between political freedom and a free market. I know of no example in time or place of a society that has been marked by a large measure of political freedom and that has not also used something comparable to a free market to organize the bulk of economic activity.
That's Milton Friedman reading a section from his 1962 book. He read that in 1996. So Benjamin Applebaum, we got to spend some time talking about Friedman here. How influential was he?
He's a fascinating guy, and I think that no economist has had a larger influence on American life, certainly in the 20th century. He's this, you know, small man who dominates any room that he's in through the force of his personality. One of his friends says everyone knows the best way to debate Milton is to wait until he leaves the room, because then you'll actually have a chance. He has this, you know, sort of bubbly personality, this joy in his view of the world. He's a relentless evangelist for it. And his view is quite simple. He says that government is the problem. Our economic problems boil down to too much management, too much bureaucracy, too much interference. He likes to joke that if the government got its hands on the Sahara Desert, there would be a shortage of sand. And he argues that the solution is for government to get out of the way.
So, and you have some wonderful details more about Friedman himself. And for example, he and his wife, the marriage of two economists there who looked at the entire world unrelentingly through that prism, to the point that even when they argued with each other, they reduced their arguments to just like numbers, like that's argument number two.
Yeah, they assign numbers to common, you know, common lines in those arguments just for the sake of efficiency, just to get it over with more quickly.
Just for the sake of efficiency. Okay. So, but tell us more about where Friedman's belief in pulling government out of the way of markets, where did that come from for him?
So I think it's important to set the stage and to say, you know, he was a child of the Great Depression. That was his he went to college during the Great Depression. That's when his intellectual foundations were set. And that was a world in which people had witnessed the collapse of the economy and were convinced that there needed to be more government management of the economy, that the necessary response to the Great Depression was for government to get its hands on the economy and manage it and prevent anything similar from happening again. And what's remarkable about Friedman is he goes in the other direction. During that same period, he begins to have doubts about this approach. He begins to argue as just a contrarian that the opposite solution is better, that instead of trying to manage the economy, the lesson of the Great Depression is that government was already doing too much and already causing problems, and that what you need to do is to get government out of the way. And for a long time, he's a voice in the wilderness making this argument. I mean, he's looked upon, his technical economics are very well regarded, but, you know, his political philosophy is looked upon as just a fringe view. But by the late 1960s, the American economy is starting to falter after this long period of post-war prosperity. And suddenly there's an interest in new ideas. And that's when Friedman finds his opening.
Okay. And then in the book, you tell the story of what one of his early successes were in shifting policy towards this direction, towards this philosophy of markets that Friedman was, you know, perhaps the champion of. And that had to do with the military draft. Can you tell us about that?
I think this is just fascinating because it's such an unexpected place for free market economists to find a foothold. And it really was the first place that they influenced government policy. After World War II, in the decades after World War II, the United States annually conscripts hundreds of thousands of young men to fill the ranks of the Army. Every year, you know, a certain number of young men are ordered to serve. And there's obviously some public anger about this, particularly among young men who would rather not serve, but it enjoys pretty broad public support for a long time. Friedman begins to argue that this is a mistake, that it is a violation of the liberties and rights of the individuals, but also that economically it's inefficient, that it would be better to pay people however much is necessary to convince them to work in the military, and let people who don't want to go do something else. So Sergeant Elvis Presley can go pursue a singing career and everyone will be better off, and someone else can serve in place of Sergeant Presley. And Friedman convinces Richard Nixon to embrace this idea. And when Nixon comes into office, he sticks with it. And in 1973, the United States ends military conscription.
But how did he convince Nixon to do it, though? Because what you're talking about is a profound shift in the entire framework through which policy is viewed, right? I mean, this has to do with who shall make up the United States military. To convince the president of the United States that efficiencies need to be the primary means by which to make that decision is a huge change.
Absolutely. So it's a two-part answer. I mean, part of this, of course, is that the context of the Vietnam War is important.
Yes.
The United States is fighting a hugely unpopular war. It needs actually a smaller share of the available men each year. So there's a growing sense that a small minority of the population is doing the work for everyone else. And so there's growing distaste for the draft as an institution for the first time. But Nixon actually turns against it even before public opinion turns against it. And that appears to be because of the success of Friedman and some of his fellow economists in convincing Nixon that you would get a better army if you paid people. The army's increasingly reliant on technology. It needs men who are willing to keep serving after their two-year conscription period ends. It spends a huge amount of money training people who just leave 2 years later, who don't want to be there while they're there. And so the idea that you could get a better military by paying for it, and importantly, the idea that it wouldn't cost that much more, is enormously persuasive.
And so, I mean, he was successful in that front. Nixon made that change. We do not, I mean, we have Selective Service now, but we haven't had a reactivation of the draft since then. So just even just staying in within this example, Benjamin, we just got about 30 seconds before the break. Like, what was the impact of Friedman's influence?
So I think most people probably are pleased that we no longer have a draft, but it hasn't been an unmitigated success. And one example of the downside is that we now have an army that can sort of serve as a line of business of the United States. People no longer feel implicated in its activities. And so we get, you know, these forever wars where we can fight and the rest of the public can basically say to themselves, these people chose to fight. They're doing their jobs. That's fine. Wars are no longer acts of national purpose.
Well, we are talking this hour with Benjamin Applebaum. His new book is The Economist's Hour, False Profits, Free Markets, and the Fracture of Society. And he writes about some of the most influential thinkers in the latter half of the 20th century that brought free market absolutism to the center of American political thinking. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Benjamin Applebaum. He's author of a new book called The Economist's Hour, False Profits, Free Markets, and the Fracture of Society. And in the book, Applebaum tells us the story of some of the most influential economists of the latter half of the 20th century, some of whom you've heard of, notably Nobel Prize winner Milton Friedman, others who you haven't, but who've had a massive impact not only on U.S. economic policy, but political philosophy as well. And we want to know what your question for Benjamin Applebaum is. Now, Benjamin, if I can, we're going to come back to Friedman, obviously, again in this conversation, because he's so central to this transformation that we're talking about. But I want to play another moment for you, which showed sort of how influential economists became, in especially the early 70s. Because this is August 15th, 1971, when President Richard Nixon addressed the American people, and he laid out quite a profound new economic roadmap for the nation. And here's what President Nixon said.
The range of actions I have taken and proposed tonight on the job front, on the inflation front, on the monetary front, is the most comprehensive new economic policy to be undertaken in this nation in four decades. We are fortunate to live in a nation with an economic system capable of producing for its people the highest standard of living in the world, a system flexible enough to change its ways dramatically when circumstances call for change, and most important, a system resourceful enough to produce prosperity with freedom and opportunity unmatched in the history of nations.
President Richard Nixon in 1971. Now, Benjamin, you talk about this moment in your book because you say this was the moment where Nixon and his economic advisors, quote, blew up the international monetary system.
That's right. It's quite a remarkable moment. In the decades after World War II, in the immediate aftermath of World War II, the United States and its allies constructed an international monetary system, a system of fixed exchange rates that provided, you know, certainty and regularity as countries traded with each other. It was called the Bretton Woods Agreement, and it lasted until the early 1970s. The Nixon administration was increasingly concerned that it was placing the United States at a disadvantage, that it was allowing nations, particularly Japan and Germany, to sell goods in the United States at relatively low prices, while American exports had become relatively overpriced. It was also costing a great deal of money just to maintain the system. And so Nixon decided to end it, and he did so under the direct counsel of his economic advisors, notably Paul Volcker, who we've mentioned earlier.
Who had risen up George, from the basement, yes.
Yes, that's right. He's on his way into the top office and up from the basement. And George Shultz, who was the first economist to serve as Treasury Secretary. Shultz in particular was a real disciple of Friedman's, and Friedman had long been advocating for the United States to allow markets to set exchange rates, to allow currency traders to determine the value, the relative value of currencies. And Shultz embraced this advice and convinced Nixon to embrace it as well. And so the United States unilaterally ended the Bretton Woods system, blew it up, and replaced it with a world in which exchange rates floated freely.
And the argument for it was what?
So Friedman's basic argument was that the markets would do a better job of determining the appropriate value of currencies, that you would get a system in which prices were at the appropriate level and you'd get a lot more stability because those prices would be based on the underlying economic fundamentals and would only change if, you know, the relative strength of say, the United States and German economies changed, and that markets would provide would do a better job than bureaucrats had been doing. It was his constant refrain. And so you replace that old system in which governments try to figure out what the right value of a currency is with a system in which you rely on the market to tell you what it should be.
And, I mean, was he wrong? Was he right? What do the following decades tell us then?
So it's complicated. He was completely wrong about the idea that currencies would be stable in a world in which they floated on the markets. Instead of floating, they dipped, they soared, they jumped all over the place. It was a turbulent new world. Friedman somehow had the idea that currency traders would tend to drive prices back toward stable levels. Instead, a new casino basically emerged in which people gambled on currency prices and sent them off in whichever direction they thought was profitable. So it was a chaotic new world. But at the same time, that new world, you know, his opponents warned that he was going to blow up the global trade system, that countries would be unable to transact with each other. And that, too, proved totally wrong. Global trade only increased in the years after the end of the Bretton Woods Agreement. Oddly enough, that system had been preserved by limiting trade. Mm. It had become impossible. Just the strain on the old system had grown so great that the United States had been forced into the position of restricting trade in order to preserve it. And with its end, trade began to explode.
Yeah. Now, I mean, there's so many fascinating details you have in this book about these major moments. One of them, coming out of this decision to blow up the Bretton Woods Accord, essentially, is just buried in one of the paragraphs in your book where you say that that Paul Volcker wasn't sure that the president's other advisors even understood the enormity of what they were about to do. Can you tell us that story?
It's an amazing story. So Nixon takes all of his advisors. They sneak out of Washington on this hot August day. And your listeners actually can find an excerpt from the book. This portion is on your website, on the On Point website. But they go up to Camp David. And they spend the weekend sort of plotting this act and preparing Nixon's speech. And Nixon retreats to his cabin to work on the final draft. And Volcker is having dinner with the other advisors. And he says to them, basically, he's worried they don't understand the enormity of it. And he says to them, you know, if I could get a little money and I could make a bet tomorrow, if I could go into financial markets tomorrow, I could make enough money to pay off the national debt, because I know what's going to happen tomorrow in the markets when this news is released. And it's going to be such a big deal that a person who knew about it ahead of time could make enough money to pay off the entire federal debt. And Nixon's chief of staff leans in and says, you know, tell me more. He's joking, but Volcker isn't wrong about the enormity of it. It's a really big deal.
Wow. So at the heart of your book is this question of, or one of the questions that, and I'm oversimplifying it here because we don't have time to like open up an economics textbook, but the idea that free markets were more efficient and better ways to run societies, you know, it's predicated on some presumptions that the market, no market is ever actually truly free, right? Because there are regulations. Just what is regulated is a political decision. Then there's also the issue of the fact that no market is purely efficient either. Like that's, I personally see that as kind of one of those chalkboard fallacies. But the fundamentals of this thinking spread throughout the American political class, and it was embraced by both parties. How did that happen? Was it because we did see huge successes, not just in the United States, but globally? Like in the intro of your book, you point out that markets did change the world.
So I think we need to begin with the story of a failure, which is that by the early 1970s, the American economy is faltering. Back then, the bogeyman was Japan rather than China. But there's this growing concern that the United States is falling behind. People are worried about the future. Both inflation and unemployment climb through the decade. By the end of the 1970s, you've got Juanita Kreps, who was the Commerce Secretary in the Carter administration, resigns from the administration because she says she's lost faith in their ability to deal with the economy. She's also a professor of economics at Duke University, and she resigns from that job, too, because she says she doesn't even know what to teach her students about economics anymore. So that's where you are at that point, is there's been a real loss of faith in the rules of the game. And it's into that void that the free market economists come and say, we have a better way. Friedman says that the way you convince policymakers to adopt your ideas is you basically have them in the fridge when they go looking for it. You know, so they open up the fridge and your idea is there, and it may become policy as a consequence. So the free market ideas were ready as an alternative at that time. And there was also an appealing modesty to it. Friedman wasn't saying, I, Milton Friedman, should be in charge of the economy, which is basically what the earlier generation of policymakers had been saying. He was saying, nobody should be in charge of the economy. He wanted to replace the Federal Reserve with a computer that just automatically increased the supply of money at a predictable pace. He wanted to get government out of the way. And that contrast with the way that things had been done, I think, was really appealing to policymakers. And so, you know, it really began to take hold. The second thing I'd say is that it was a successful revolution in its early phases. There were real problems, and an increased reliance on markets was important in many areas, notably, for example, commercial air travel, where the deregulation of the airlines enormously reduced the price of flying, enormously increased the availability of flights. But it's a revolution that went too far. That's really the core of it.
Mm. Well, I just want to take a short little stroll through history here to hear how these core ideas were really embraced by the American political class. So first of all, here's Milton Friedman again in a 1977 speech at Cornell University explaining what he saw as the essence of a capitalist system, quote, in its pure form.
That it is a system of cooperation without compulsion, of voluntary exchange, of free enterprise. Now, I hasten to add, no actual system conforms to that notion. In the actual world, you always have impediments and interferences to voluntary exchange. But the essential character of a capitalist system is that it relies on voluntary exchange, on your agreeing with me that you will buy something from me if I will pay you a certain amount for it. The essential notion is that both parties to the exchange must benefit.
Milton Friedman in 1977, and as Benjamin Applebaum says in his book, that Friedman's basic idea was simple, that open marketplaces, quote, were the best possible system of human governance, much better than traditional forms of government, which ought to be kept to an absolute minimum. So with that in mind, let's listen to President Bill Clinton in his 1996 State of the Union address.
We know big government does not have all the answers. We know there's not a program for every problem. We know, and we have worked to give the American people a smaller, less bureaucratic government in Washington. And we have to give the American people one that lives within its means. The era of big government is over. But we cannot go back to the time when our citizens were left to fend for themselves.
President Bill Clinton in 1996, and fast forward again to 2019, just May of this year, where Judy Shelton, economic advisor to President Donald Trump, told CNBC why she thinks a free market economy is succeeding under the president's current administration.
I have more faith in free market mechanisms, a more organically determined rate. I think something fundamental has changed from the earlier days prior to the Trump administration. What we now have is a genuine pro-growth economic agenda.
Now, Benjamin, the reason why I wanted to sort of play those quotes back to back is just to underscore the bipartisan embrace of quote-unquote free market thinking here, but also to ask you, has it become a faith? I mean, has it become a faith amongst politicians that free markets are the best answer?
I think it has. It's a classic example of an idea that became simplified to the point of absurdity. So it would have been obvious to people in earlier eras that markets were human creations. Markets were often literally defined spaces in the middle of a town that happened at a particular time of day. Often a bell would ring at the beginning and at the end. We now live in a marketplace, basically. It's a 24/7, 365 reality for us. And particularly in the mid-century, that market seemed to be working well, and people just lost track of the fact that it was constructed. They began to treat it as if it was natural, naturally occurring, as if government was intervening into a space where it did not, have a place. And this argument got simplified, as it often does in political discourse, up until the point where you basically have both Democrats and Republicans talking about government as a negative force in the marketplace, whereas the reality has always been that government is constitutive of marketplaces. It creates them. It writes the rules. They can only exist in the context of those rules. And so this simplification, this creation of an opposition between governments and markets, it is a faith, and it's a misguided faith.
And not to heap this all on Friedman, but he's just such a central character here. In the clip that we played earlier in the show, I mean, Friedman himself said, "I know of no example in time or place where a society that has been marked by a large measure of political freedom that has not also used something comparable to a free market to organize the bulk of economic activity." I mean, he himself tightly bound the two together.
And it's really important to say, because the words get slippery here, that, I mean, Friedman is right that market-based economies are the predominant model, but there are degrees of market-based economies. A market-based economy doesn't mean the absence of regulation. It doesn't mean that the government doesn't attempt to invest in long-term growth or to provide for citizens in the form of a safety net. So if you hear him saying that, and what you take away from it is that the absence of government is the best thing, you're drawing the wrong historical lesson.
Well, but so then how I mean, we don't know of all the discussions, obviously, that happen between these economists and political leaders here. But, you know, if the idea is that free markets promote growth and that growth is eventually good for all, the issue that we're wrestling now is the massive inequality that was produced by these systems. I mean, was the concern about inequality, which the United States had previously suffered earlier in the 20th century, was that even a concern for these economists in the latter half of the 20th century?
So in the mid-century, there had been a real compression of inequality. The level of inequality had been significantly reduced. And in that context, people were not particularly focused on it as an issue. But one of the most important things that economists said and preached and convinced policymakers was that there was a trade-off between focusing on inequality and trying to reduce inequality on the one hand and maximizing economic growth on the other hand. That a society that was trying to make sure that there was inequality of outcomes would inevitably suffer slower growth as a consequence. And so they urged policymakers to focus on maximizing growth and to set aside a concern for redistribution or equality of opportunity. And they argued basically that that would be okay, that as long as everyone was benefiting, it shouldn't matter if some people were benefiting more. That was a message that frankly appealed immensely to elites. You were basically telling rich people that they were doing what was best for society by, making as much money as possible. You were validating corporations and their role in the economy. And it really took hold. And that message is at the root of our current problems.
Well, we are talking this hour with Binyamin Applebaum. He's got a fascinating new book out. It's called The Economist's Hour: False Profits, Free Markets, and the Fracture of Society. We'll take a bunch of calls when we come back. This is On Point.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with Binyamin Applebaum. He writes about economics and business for the editorial page of the New York Times. But he's also got this new book out. It's called The Economist's Hour: False Profits, Free Markets, and the Fracture of Society. And in it, he tells the story of the most influential economists in the United States. And actually, they had great influence, obviously, around the world in transforming American economic and political philosophy, I should say, towards the sacrosanct nature or belief in free markets as a great solution to just about everything. I mean, in Binyamin's book, he points out that between 1969 and 2008, economists persuaded Richard Nixon to end military conscription. Economists persuaded the federal judiciary largely to abandon the enforcement of antitrust laws. Economists even persuaded the government to assign a dollar value to human life, around $10 million in 2019, to determine whether regulations are worthwhile. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. Binyamin, tons of callers, so let's let them in. Phil is calling from Mount Horeb, Wisconsin. Phil, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm concerned. I am also confused by Friedman's unreserved defense of the free market. From a standpoint of corporations are primarily concerned about their quarterly profit margins and their annual returns. This is not my estimation, the benefit to society that corporations are in our society assigned. I think that we need more government regulation to make sure that our resources are conserved, that our resources are recycled, that we can preserve this society and its wealth and its opportunity for future generations, not just for the short-term benefit of the elites, which I see happening now.
Well, Phil, thank you for your call. Benjamin, you want to respond to him?
The idea that corporations should focus solely on profitability, on returns to their shareholders, is another of Friedman's intellectual contributions to modern life. He argued famously in an essay in the New York Times in the early 1970s that corporations should abandon a broader sense of public purpose or obligation, that the way that they would do the most good for the world is by just trying to make as much money as possible. It's really a classic example of his faith in markets, and it was enormously influential. And it is now one of the many aspects of that sort of free market economist's hour that's under reconsideration. The Business Roundtable, a leading lobby for the business community, has just actually announced just this summer a reformulation of its mission statement to reflect the idea that corporations have responsibilities that extend beyond just making money.
Mm. Well, let's go to Dave, who's calling from Ithaca, New York. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So one of the concerns that I have is that many of the challenges that we seem to face as a world community, such as global warming, overpopulation, pollution, et cetera, seem to be more a consequence of our, I guess, allegiance or just sort of our dedication to a growth mentality, and that these things are, you know, they're a consequence of this lifestyle rather than something that all, you know, always has been. And so I guess I'd just like to hear your comment about the problems that I perceive as a society that's a bit out of whack and addicted to growth.
Dave, thank you. Benjamin, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I think that the legacy of the Economist's Hour, we've talked a little bit about it, but it's primarily three things. The first is that we actually didn't get increased growth in any significant way. Growth has been declining decade over decade since the 1960s. The second is massive inequality. This indifference to inequality resulted in a lot more inequality, and that has turned out to be much worse than we were told. Inequality itself is harmful. It mimics the effects of poverty in many ways. But the last aspect of it is that this focus on growth has also come at the expense of the future. The turn away from government meant that government was no longer investing in the economy. So the 1990s, which are often remembered as sort of the last time everything was going right, I think are really better described as a period in which we were picking all the fruit in the orchard. We had, for example, the most educated workforce in the developed world because of the investments we had made in education in the mid-century. But we weren't continuing to invest. We weren't funding research. We weren't funding infrastructure. We weren't funding education. And the consequence is that the current generation is no longer the most educated in the developed world, and we're running short on ideas. And, you know, the environment is another dimension on which I think, you know, our sort of short-term focus on maximizing growth is coming at a tremendous long-term expense.
Now, just to clarify something, when you say growth has been declining, you mean the rate of growth has been declining in the United States?
The average pace of growth in the United States, average annual growth, has been slower in each decade since the 1960s.
But people would point to other places in the world where the opposite has been true.
So there are countries that have done better than the United States. There are countries that have done worse. But one really interesting point about this, and this gets back to inequality, it's one of my favorite sort of statistics, is that if you look at France, everyone knows the United States has grown faster than France, and a lot of Americans regard that as a marker of the success of our economic system. But if you exclude the top 1% of the population in France and in the United States, income growth for the 99% has been much faster in France than in the United States. So it's not just aggregate growth that matters. You really want to focus on the distribution.
Yeah. But as you know, as late as 2004 and perhaps even later, but in your book you quote Nobel laureate Robert Lucas in 2004. I mean, when talking about inequality, he warned against any effort to reduce it. I mean, this is a quote that you have in your book, that of the tendencies that are harmful to sound economics, the most seductive and, in my opinion, the most poisonous is to focus on questions of distribution. That's from a Nobel Prize-winning economist.
It's a remarkable statement, and it absolutely reflects the thinking of many economists.
Wow. Well, let's go to Nate, who's calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Nate, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me. I was going to bring up what's the free market solution of global warming other than waiting for cities to flood and then everybody suing oil companies till they go bankrupt. Also, the whole idea of free markets bringing free governments. I look at China right now, which seems to have an increasingly free market system, and their government is actually seems to be going a little more authoritarian rather than less.
Yeah, Nate, that's a really interesting point. I want to bring it up with Benjamin Applebaum. Thank you for your call. So what does the China story and opening up of markets tell us about these ideas?
So Friedman's original claim was that societies that had freedom would also have free markets. But he did at times advance the opposite claim, which is that free markets would lead to freedom. And this wasn't just Friedman. This was actually quite a bipartisan view in the United States that if China in particular could be encouraged to open its markets and to develop a capitalist economy, it was inevitable that it would also tend toward democracy. And I think it's, you know, very clear at this point that that was wrong.
Huh. Well, let's go to Tom, who's calling from Fort Dodge, Iowa. Tom, you're on the air.
Yes. My concern has been that we don't realize the obvious in that our government no longer superior to the economists might say, or the special interests. Our government is not responsive to us, but responsive to the free market mentality.
Mm.
Not that I'm against a free market. I'm against anything that supplants the will of the people, the best interest of the people. And when we don't have representatives representing us, our interests, rather than the free market interests, we could end up with anything right. And none of it good.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Joy, who's calling from West Bend, Wisconsin. Joy, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you to the guest speaker for writing a good book. I want to know what your alternative vision is. We need to have knowledgeable people like you putting forth great ideas so we can build on them. It seems like socialism is a dirty word, and if we had a real democracy, maybe we could develop a socialism vision. Mm-hmm. What is your idea?
Benjamin, what do you think?
Well, you know, I think that the problem we are confronting is inequality, and so the solution is to make inequality, reducing inequality, a focus of public policy. That it sounds simple, but it's something we simply haven't done for the last 40 years. And I think that the solution begins by doing that. And I'll give you one simple example of a policy that we know works and helps, and that's universal pre-kindergarten. Getting kids into the classroom at an early age begins to level the playing field and allows children from different economic backgrounds the opportunity to thrive. And that's ultimately not just good for them, but for society as a whole.
But, I mean, are we in a place where our understanding of what capitalism is has become so overly simplified that it's hard to imagine a system a capitalistic system that addresses issues of inequality? Do you see what I'm getting at? Because it seems like, as you say, like it's described as a natural consequence. Inequality is described as a natural consequence of capitalism. That doesn't have to be true.
In the 1930s, during the Great Depression, when people were losing faith in capitalism and in the operation of markets, the great economist John Maynard Keynes set out to do what he described as saving capitalism from itself. His idea was that, you know, this unfettered faith in markets was not good for markets and it wasn't good for society, but that a regulated marketplace remained the best possible system of economic organization. And so the imposition of better rules and regulations, of restraints, of an active hand of government in the marketplace was necessary to make the market work. And I think that's where we find ourselves again. This unfettered faith in free markets has caused markets to break down. You know, a really easy example of this is the airline industry, where we've allowed so much consolidation that for the first time in history, it's now cheaper to fly in Europe than it is to fly in the United States. The market has stopped working. It's not an accident that when you go online, everybody quotes you the same price for your flight. And that's, you know, that's what we're now confronting, is the need to revive the function of a regulated marketplace.
You know, the airline example is really interesting to me, Benjamin, because there are, I've heard from any number of people who say, well, regulations have existed. They've just been in favor of a small few.
So, I mean, it's important to sort of differentiate among the kinds of regulations. Yeah. So there are health and safety regulations that obviously have been very successful in keeping planes in the air. But in the mid-century, the government literally regulated every aspect of commercial air travel. To fly between cities, you needed a federal license. You had to come to Washington and make an application to a board that sat here and convince them that you should be allowed to fly an airplane between, you know, Milwaukee and St. Louis or whatever it was. What you could serve on the airplane was subject to federal regulation. The price of the ticket was subject to federal regulation. So it was an extremely constrained marketplace. And as I said earlier, that all was dismantled, and I think mostly for the better. But what got lost along the way is that the government also removed the antitrust barriers that previously had preserved competition in that industry. And by doing so, allowed a consolidation that has left us with, you know, four big carriers, none of which seem to incline to compete with each other on price.
Let's get one more call in here. Michael's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, I had this, an idea I always had that capitalism is obviously based on competition being a good thing, and that one part of the problem we have today was the loss of competition with the end of the Cold War. Capitalism for years had to prove in competition with communism, it was better. It produced a better society, and the loss of that, it no longer had that sort of competition and allowed these sort of unfettered excesses that we see today.
Michael, thank you so much for your call. Benjamin, you actually write about this in your book. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's such a great point. You know, during the mid-century, capitalist countries felt an acute responsibility to demonstrate that capitalism would better provide for all of their citizens than did communism. And they were enormously successful in doing that, in making sure that prosperity was broadly shared. The end of the Cold War, ironically, was interpreted as a victory for a different kind of capitalism. The conservative columnist George Will famously wrote that the Cold War is over and the University of Chicago has won. Well, the University of Chicago was not what won the Cold War. What won the Cold War was the type of activist government and safety net programs that, you know, provided for Americans and the citizens of other Western democracies in the mid-century. But with the loss, with the end of communism, capitalism sort of took a turn to the right and purified itself and became, you know, even more so. And this sense of what had actually happened was lost. And it became a monopolist, basically, a monopolist in the marketplace of ideas, self-satisfied, fat, and not interested in criticism. So I think that's a really powerful point about the consequence of the end of the Cold War.
I want to come back to one thing that you wrote in the beginning of your book, Benjamin, because you do write that the embrace of markets lifted billions of people around the world from abject poverty. Infant mortality is lower today than it was in 1950 on every country on the face of the earth. And markets make it easier for people to get what they want when they want different things, a virtue that is particularly important in pluralistic societies. So, you know, nothing is either entirely good or entirely bad, of course, here. But what the reason why I wanted to read that is because there's a lot of evidence that these big ideas had a huge impact. And so one of the sort of undercurrents of your book are the force of big ideas. So what is the big idea now that is best poised to counterbalance the negative effects of a half century of the Economist's hour?
Well, I'll tell you one thing that we are learning. We've had this, four decades of data and accumulated experience about, you know, what it's like, particularly with regard to inequality. And what we've learned is that inequality is really harmful, that countries with high levels of inequality actually grow slower over time than countries with lower levels of inequality, that basic sort of foundational premise that economists preached in the mid-century was quite simply wrong. And so, again, I think, you know, the big idea going forward needs to be that inequality needs to be treated seriously as a policy problem. And by doing that, we may be able to find a firmer basis for, a free market society that is constructed on sustainable principles.
Well, Benjamin Applebaum's new book is The Economist's Hour, False Profits, Free Markets, and the Fracture of Society. We do have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. It's been great to talk with you, Benjamin. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And as I mentioned in the beginning, Benjamin's the first part of what I'm calling like a little mini pop-up series on capitalism and its discontents. He walked us through some of the big players in late 20th century economic thinking. Tomorrow, we're going to ask what the future of this system is. globally. So that's the second half of our little pop-up series on capitalism. That's tomorrow on the program, so join us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.